Welcome to Acts of Kitchen, the fortnightly podcast of food and cooking stories. My name's Alex, and well, this fortnight I could tell you about how I'm never ever going to make polenta again after I spent a ridiculous amount of time trying to get it out of the pot that I cooked it in. I could tell you about the amazing upside down mango cake that I made that had lime zest and yogurt, as well as an impressive pile of mango along the bottom. But I'm not going to do that because, frankly, this fortnight my interview is really the star. I got to interview Jackie French. If you're Australian, or perhaps even if you're not, you'll probably know the name Jackie French, especially if you have small children or have been around small children over the last couple of decades. You may know of a book that she wrote that stars a wombat. You may also know of her historical fiction, of her young adult fiction, and, as I discovered, you might also know about the gardening and food books that she has written and the columns as well. Jackie French is a true storyteller. She's a remarkable person, and the stories that she tells are absolutely captivating. I hope you enjoy it. Hi, Jackie. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
A pleasure.
I wanted to start by asking you whether you've always been interested in food and cooking, or if that's something that has developed later in life.
I always loved food. I can remember, I must have been about three, I think, serving the little boy next door a bowl full of dirt sprinkled with salt and pepper and nicely set on a tree, on the table under the tree, etc. And his mother racing out to actually stop us eating it. I think we'd probably eaten about half a bowl full, and I still remember the taste, actually. It actually tasted not too bad. But then I was only used to my mother's cooking. Now, my mother has contributed many incredibly good things to the world, but edible meals are not one of them. She actually became quite ill when I was about three. In fact, from when I was about three, four, and five, she had a series of miscarriages, and I took over the cooking, which basically meant we lived on Vegemite toast for a few weeks. So I learned how to grill chops and then boil potatoes and boil other vegetables. And back then, boiled and grilled and baked was pretty much what it was in Australia. But from then on, I cooked a lot of the family's meals. But I had certainly no instruction from my mother. In fact, the only meal I think my mother has cooked in the past 30 years was when I brought my husband up to meet her. And she decided she would cook him steak. And he arrived first. I was doing a work event. And as the taxi went up the road, you could see these clouds of smoke coming out of the house and saying, yes, that's it, the one with the smoke coming out. She was trying to actually cook him a steak.
Oh, dear.
As I said, I think that was the only meal she'd actually tried to cook in all of those years. We used to have a game that we would play on Bribie Island when I was a kid with my brothers and sister. What can we find in the stew tonight? And there'd be things like bits of wood and paddle pop sticks and string. And when frozen chickens came along, she never did get over the fact that you actually had to take the plastic innards out. So when I say she was a bad cook, she really was an appalling cook. She actually doesn't care about food. This just isn't really. Well, I have to say, we ate very healthily. We always had a lot of vegetables, even if they were boiled. We always had a lot of fruit on hand. So we ate extremely healthy meals, but not ones to actually please the palate. They were necessary fuel for the body. But my grandmother, who lived in Sydney, and now I grew up outside Brisbane, Sydney was at least a two-day drive away. Driving down, you even had to get ferries across rivers, etc. So it was a considerable journey. But I would either go down and spend my holidays with grandma, or she'd come up and I'd spend the holidays with her. And grandma was one of the most perfect cooks I have ever come across. I've still got her cookery book, which was started started for her by her mother when Grandma was about 12. This was about 1912. It's got the oldest recorded recipe of Anzac biscuits on it, 1916. But none of the recipes in it, apart from the Anzacs, are the ones that Grandma used, because, of course, Grandma did not cook from recipes. She didn't have a very wide repertoire. Basically, most of what she cooked was actually based on sheep. There would be sort of chops with gravy for breakfast. Grandma's day started with early morning tea, which was always actually things like sort of crackers with cheese and tomato or something like that, which would give you the strength then to actually go on for a three-course breakfast, which would give you the strength to go shopping for the food for the rest of the day. Grandma had grown up in the country, and so she was used to getting fresh vegetables every day, and when I knew her, she lived in the city. But she would still shop for fresh vegetables and fresh meat every day. She wouldn't store it. The idea of using 2 or 3 day-old vegetables was just inconceivable for her. So then you go shopping, which would mean then stopping for morning tea, which would then give you the strength to prepare a three-course lunch. By the time you'd actually cleaned that away and actually made afternoon tea and started to put dinner on, that would mean afternoon tea. Then there was dinner, again, three courses. And then, of course, there was supper. And usually supper involved things like toasting the scones left over from earlier in the day. I still remember when the man who was going to become my first husband dropped me off at Grandma's. We'd been to the ballet. And I think he was hoping for a sort of cuddle in the doorway. Instead, there is Grandma in her pearls having prepared this incredibly lavish supper of sandwiches and toasted scones and at least 8 or 10 different foods. And he was expected to actually sit down and eat for 2 solid hours before he was allowed to finally stagger out the door. Grandma liked feeding people. I think it's a gene. I've inherited it. My niece has inherited it. It's not so much that we love cooking, though we do. It's not so much that we enjoy eating, which we certainly do. But watching Michaela, who decided that her sister needed 3 wedding cakes, not just 1 wedding cake, etc., made by her, of course, we just love feeding people. If I make a stew, it's usually a really, really vast stew, which I'll freeze or give away to people. So I learned the very basics of cooking from Grandma, but also from the age of 12 onwards, I worked in commercial kitchens. Our family was actually going through a very broke stage with Dad's bankruptcy, so he lied about my age and said I was 14 instead of 12. So for the Christmas holidays that year, for 6 weeks, it was my first job at the kitchen of the Mater Mothers Hospital. And in those days, their hospital food was wonderful. The nuns at that hospital knew that nursing mothers needed good feeding, particularly at 2 a.m. in the morning. So there would be these benches full of sponge cakes with strawberries and passion fruit sponges and lamingtons and jam drops and things like that. And it was magnificent. These women who really, really knew how to cook, with a very, very heavy emphasis on extremely nice and tempting sweet things to keep you going. And the sister in charge was very, very, very Irish. And whenever she came in, someone would slowly put a tape of Irish music on, and she would climb up onto the table, lift up her skirts, and do an Irish jig for us. And I will never, ever forget it in my life. It was a place of real camaraderie. It was women cooking together. I was just doing the washing up. I wasn't entrusted with cooking anything. And it was lovely. We knew we were women cooking for other women who were having babies. And it was superb. I left home at 15, or was kicked out of home at 15. And for my holiday jobs then, to support myself, again, I chose places that involved kitchens, not just because I enjoyed cooking, and also you needed some degree of expertise to get there. And by then I was actually building up a reasonable CV. But also, of course, because you were fed. One of my favourites was the National Hotel in Brisbane. I started work there at 6 o'clock in the morning. And look, looking at my photograph from back then, I look, well, I was starving. I'm unrecognisable in the photograph, this incredibly thin face with enormous eyes. And anyway, the women took one look at me and set breakfast in front of me, and I was not allowed to get up and start work till I ate it, and every morning it would be there. Now, we are to a steak, not a breakfast steak. We are talking the sort of steak that overlaps the plate. There was a steak, there was a sausage, there was two fried eggs, there was tomato, there was usually actually sort of bubble and squeak of leftover vegetables, etc., fried up, etc., with two enormous pieces of toast with marmalade. And I had to eat every scrap before I was allowed to do anything else. The place was nominally in control of the chef, but in the heat of Brisbane, he spent the day actually sitting in the cool room with a bottle of rum or carving shapes out of dripping. And it was the women who did the cooking. And there was Anna, who was from Yugoslavia. Sorry, Anna was Russian. Olga from Yugoslavia. Julie, who was Italian. Julie was always having problems with her daughter-in-law, who could never cook properly. Olga would tell me stories of going mushrooming in her childhood in the forest and getting eggs warm from the chicken. And they all taught me cooking. I still remember Julie showing me how to cook pasta. So it's ready when you throw a bit at the wall. And if it sticks, it's ready. If it slops off, it's overcooked, etc., or it's undercooked. But if it's cooked perfectly, a tiny bit of pasta thrown at the wall will stick just for a little while before it slides down again. And Anna showing me how to make these incredible, perfect omelettes, which I have to say, I still make an incredibly good omelette. And it's all in actually the shaking of the pan and the flipping. And they would all say, oh, your husband will thank me for this. And he does, indeed. And so, look, from them, I learnt the sort of cooking that Australians didn't do, the making of sauces, the cooking of mushrooms, etc., etc., the making of omelettes. But also in my second year at university, I fell in love. I went to live with a man who was caretaking an avocado orchard. And he was also at university, and so while I was at university, we were also living on the farm. And that was where, again, because we didn't have a lot of money, though as we both had scholarships, we weren't too badly off. But nonetheless, we both liked to eat well. And so we started to grow vegetables and certainly lived as much as possible from the fruit and the eggs, etc., that grew on the farm or the market gardens around. And from that time onwards, I've pretty much based what we eat on what is growing around us. It's actually second nature. I remember when CSIRO came out with its first health survey, and I did it and was infuriated to find out that I scored very low, and they said I needed more fruit and vegetables. Now, it'd be almost impossible physically to stuff in more fruit and vegetables and more variety than I do. And I wrote them quite a long letter pointing out that they simply were not taking into account seasonal vegetables. No, I had not eaten any pumpkins because this was spring and the pumpkins were finished. But in the last 2 days, I had eaten over 30 different fruits and vegetables, but most of them were not listed there. They only had listed things like actually peas, carrots, corn, and most of the things that they had listed there simply were not in season. They needed to make it much wider so that, look, you could have things like artichokes and cardoons and Jerusalem artichokes and things like that. And to my surprise, they took notice, because the one that's come out now does include all of those things. It's basically, it gives you a choice in the variety of what you eat. So here, yes, we've got the vegetable gardens. We've got a lot of perennial vegetables, which, as I'm speaking now, my knees have decided to finally stop working, and I'm due to surgery fairly soon. And having perennial vegetables makes such a difference, because even now, when I haven't been able to garden much in the last 3 months, I won't be able to for at least another 3 months, the garden is still providing for us. We've got about 800 fruit trees. We've got 132 varieties of apples, which crop from late November through to August, which, as Brian says, is a bit excessive. excessive for the two of us. But then again, he is very, very fond of apple crumble and apple cake and various other apple-based things. And so, yes, we eat really according to the season. I love recipes, but I read them primarily for ideas. Once you learn to cook, you don't look at a recipe and then go and buy the ingredients, but you look at what is available and then you draw on your store of recipes, your kitchen knowledge, etc., or some inspiration from other recipes you've read and say, okay, this is what I've got to cook. Now, how am I going to cook it? So for lunch, for example, at the moment, we're almost invariably just actually having vegetable soups. I call it bottom of the garden soup. And it varies according to the season. Oh, about 2 months ago, for example, it was pretty much tomato soup for a while. And then it was sort of roast tomato and roast capsicum and roast carrot soup blended together. And at the moment, it's a whole variety of all sorts of vegetables with either barley or arancini pasta in it. And yes, so we would go for the carrots and the parsnips and the parsley and the celery and chocos because they've actually just started. And yes, whatever else is around. Using a stock though, which I do freeze a lot of stock, so it's tomato based and a whole lot of herbs and things like that as well. But the soup is never the same. There would be people who would say, oh, this soup is delicious, can we have it again? I would manage a soup which is sort of the same, but I don't think I've ever made two identical soups in my life. They are always based on what's in the garden, but also too, the flavours vary. With the carrots that we grow here, they're so rich in carotene, they turn everything orange. You put one carrot in something and then you know the result is going to be orange, whereas if I make it from supermarket carrots, you really can't tell the difference. And that too, it does make a difference in terms of what you're eating. I'll use thyme all the year round, but it simply doesn't have the flavour in winter that it does in summer. Basil at the moment tastes wonderful, but it's quite different from midsummer basil. Parsley now is the most perfect parsley you can eat because I'm talking about autumn now. And so beautifully tender, far more tender than it is in midsummer. But it's really, the cold has really brought out the sweetness in the parsley. Whereas in a month or two, in midwinter, it'll be okay, but it won't have the heat to give it that lushness and the luxuriousness. So we're having very, very parsley-rich things at the moment. And again, I'm freezing soups with a lot of parsley in them. Parsley may be a year-round crop, but like every crop, it's best in certain seasons.
Your garden sounds absolutely incredible. How long has it taken you to get it to this point? How many years have you been working on it?
Well, look, I've been here for about 46 years, but the garden and some of those trees are that old. But it probably took about 15 to 20 years to get to the stage where the trees are just reliably cropping, etc. But if you're looking for a self-sufficient garden, if you're just looking for annuals, lots of melons and chocos and things like that, you can do that in 1 year or even in 6 good months of growing. But probably 6 or 7 years, but depends on your climate. We go down to -9 here, so it can take a while for trees to bear, whereas if you're in a much warmer part of Australia, of course, your garden is going to be far more productive far sooner than it is here.
And are you still looking for things to add to your garden? Are there things that you feel are missing, or are you looking for new varieties?
Yes. What I'm missing is one of those lovely Victorian steel and glass heated glass houses, which would cost roughly about $500,000, would be heated, and we don't have any flat ground where we can put it. But if anyone's actually got a spare one, I would love it. And if I had that, I could actually grow chocolate and pepper. We do have coffee bushes. I'm staring at one at the moment, but it's in the sunny corner of the living room. We probably need about another 6 of those, but Brian refers to the coffee bush as the Triffid, and I don't think he really wants any more Triffids taking up our living room. It is getting rather large. I used to take it outdoors in summer, but now it's too big to move. So, no, I think Brian thinks one is far more than enough. So, look, there are lots of other things I would like, including more coffee bushes. We do have tea bushes. They grow very well in our cold climate. But I would love to be able to grow chocolate, and I'd love to be able to grow more coffee and a few other tropical things. But by using niche planting, I mean, we grow avocados. We grow pawpaws, but they don't taste of anything. We grow mangoes, but they haven't fruited yet. We grow bananas, but they don't taste of anything either. We're simply too cold to really get good flavour with tropical things.
I know one of your interests is the environment ecology and environmental sustainability and things. Does that come out of your interest in growing your own food and so on, or are they separate interests?
No, I think they're pretty much one thing. I love this small, strange, blue planet of life whizzing through the darkness. It is incredible. The generosity of this planet. This is a planet where over most of its Earth's surface, apart from the poles, you can just walk and eat. If you can't, it's because humans have disturbed it. This is a place where in the bush around me, yes, you can just walk forever and just eat. The food is there for you. And that's certainly the case. Europe, the Americas, Africa, etc. Food is all around us. And yet people don't realise we are on such an incredibly generous planet, and we are destroying that generosity. 5 years ago, the valley where I live was Australia's second largest peach-producing area. The peaches, Araluen peaches, Wisby's peaches, were famous, were valued overseas. And then the government gave permission for a mine, a gold mine upstream. They put in a proposal to use cyanide to process it, and the banks put a moratorium on lending any money. And the orchard ran on an overdraft for pruning and spraying, and the bank would not keep that overdraft going because of the cyanide, and also because of the cyanide as well. The Japanese in particular would never import fruit from an area where the water could be polluted by cyanide. The mine hasn't started, but it began construction, and in the first 6 months of construction, there were five major pollution events, though that was just sediment that hadn't started with cyanide. Anyway, the orchards were pulled out. The farmers simply could not afford to do the spraying and the pruning that was necessary to stop it being an ecological disaster. 3 weeks after that, the company withdrew the cyanide proposal. It never would have got through anyway. But just the threat of that for 9 months was enough to destroy the peach industry. One of the most productive areas in Australia now no longer produces fruit and vegetables, except in places like ours where we don't sell them. 29 people lost their jobs, 26,000 peach trees were pulled out, and more are still being taken out now of different trees. This is an incredibly generous earth, but human beings, for the most stupid reasons, are destroying it. So my interest in the environment, we are part of the environment. We feed ourselves, and look, I have no problem with the idea too that when I die, I'm going to feed the earth as well. There will be lots of microorganisms, etc., turning me back into soil. We are part of this incredibly generous planet. And where it is not generous, it is because humans have failed to understand how generous this is. White colonists came to a land of living larders where trees and grain crops and vines, etc., had been planted to continually feed you generation after generation after generation. And we did not recognize it. We didn't recognize that every step you took would take you to another source of food. Food was all around. But instead, they actually cut it down, they poisoned it, they ring-barked it, etc. They shot so many animals that, again, they weren't the animals to eat, but they brought in sheep and goats instead of actually eating the animals which are so necessary to our ecology. The kangaroos, etc., that carry microflora and seeds in their droppings, the microflora that make phosphorus and other elements more available to plants, the seeds which will survive droughts in dry droppings, so that if it doesn't rain for 20 years, there'll still be seeds. So the pasture and particularly the grain-bearing grasses will cover the earth again. We simply did not realise what a generous earth we were destroying. And it is still happening with fracking, etc. The decisions are being made by people who simply do not understand what they are destroying. They do not understand that water systems may go for tens or hundreds of thousands of miles. And if you destroy them, you destroy not just the natural generosity, but even our farming systems, 10 kilometres away, hundreds or even thousands. And not only that, once they are destroyed, it may take thousands of years for them to come back again, unless we put an incredible amount of work into the reclamation. Mostly, the people on this planet now do not understand the generosity of the world around them. And that is one of the things that I do put into so many books. It's not an attempt really to make kids and the people who read them understand the generosity of the planets. It's just there because that is how I view the world. I do use food, though, very much as an index to the society I'm writing about. In A Waltz for Matilda, when all they can afford is actually a very, very tough and inedible swan, which one of the shearers has bought as his contribution to Christmas dinner. In terms of the characters themselves, what they eat, how they eat it, it says a lot about the times, it says a lot about the people. But I do that in real life as well. I don't think it's coincidence that all of my friends are enthusiastic eaters and enthusiastic cooks. Creative people like to create. Friendly people like to feed people. They don't necessarily like to cook. I mean, I'm married to a man who doesn't cook much, but he's a very, very enthusiastic and discriminating eater. I can't think of any of my friends who is not either a discriminating cook or a very, very discriminating eater and who enjoys eating. Life should be lived, and eating is part of that. And I would find it very hard, I think, to feel, well, the sort of empathy you feel with a friend for someone who didn't actually live their life, including eating.
I have to say, Jackie, that I think there will be some people listening to this who will have been somewhat amazed that I've managed to go for 20 minutes on this podcast without talking to you about your books, which are probably the reason why most Australians have heard of you. So that was quite epic.
Well, look, even Diary of a Wombat, I mean, that is actually a book about food.
Yes, of course.
For a wombat. And wombats have got life figured out very well. life is sleeping, eating, scratching, and very occasionally mating. And for a wombat, all of Diary of a Wombat is basically about food. A wombat, who in fact was a real
Diary of a Wombat.
Yes. Mothball was a very real wombat. Wild Whiskers, her daughter, and her two granddaughters still live near us. And mothball had actually been raised by humans, and that's where she discovered that while grass is wonderful, carrots are even better as a luxury. She likes a varied diet, and again, rolled oats. Sometimes you feel like rolled oats as well. So this is a wombat who definitely regards good food as her right and will train humans to get it. But it is at heart a book about food. I've had so many wonderful letters from schools saying that the kids now turn up at the school canteen or tuck shop and demand carrots. A lovely letter from the USA where the kids are given lunch and the kids were going on strike demanding that they provided raw carrots to eat after lunch. And they were calling them wombat sticks. They wanted their wombat sticks, and they were not leaving unless they had a carrot. So yes, they've now been buying sacks of carrots, and after every lunch or at morning tea, etc., the kids are demanding their carrots, and they're getting very stroppy if they don't get them.
Truly, you have had an amazing impact.
Well, I think I should possibly get an award by the Carrot Growers Association.
Absolutely.
If there is any such thing.
You have a wonderfully varied bibliography, from Diary of a Wombat to so many amazing books for kids and for young adults. And I'm embarrassed to admit that I actually didn't realise that you'd written some non-fiction as well, in particular books about gardening and ecology. Now, obviously, these are really important subjects for you. Was it different to write about those as compared to writing your fiction?
No, it's the same. Look, I also write gardening columns. Probably my most important non-fiction book is Get the Land Speak, which is a far too long history of Australia from the point of view of the land itself, from 60,000 years ago to the present. Or in fact, one of the chapters is basically how to survive the next millennia, its predictions about what is going to happen. That was difficult because the predictions kept on coming true while the book was still being printed, so including the Christchurch earthquake. So we had to keep on adding new predictions because they just actually happened. But no, my work, whether it's fiction or non-fiction, is very much a collection of data. So when you write fiction or non-fiction, it's a matter of collecting data and putting it together in patterns that form either theories of ecology or views of history or images of what the world was like 50 years ago, 60 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago. It's all collecting data, analysing data, putting data into patterns, and then turning those patterns into something on the page as clearly and vividly as you can. And some are complete non-fiction, but even my fiction is always very, very strongly based on fact. I profoundly hope there is nothing in any of my historical fictions that contradicts any known fact about history. Sorry, any substantiated fact about history, because often the point where I begin is where I think that many historians, or even most, have got it wrong. Or more likely, they haven't got it wrong because they made a mistake. It's just that as archival material is released, becomes available, is discovered, we have more information, and so we suddenly realise we've been looking at a particular area in the wrong way. And so I will be writing a reinterpretation of that history. But in terms of the way I write, no. If I'm writing a work of fiction, the land will be accurate. The sort of characters, the words they use, their motivations will be of the time. The food they eat and the life they lead will be of the time itself.
Jackie, a final question then. Do you have a favourite meal or a favourite food?
Yes, but it probably changes day by day. Look, it depends. It depends what I feel like. It depends what is available. It depends what is in season. And it is very, very, very seasonal. If I'm asked that, I often say something like eggplant parmigiana, purely because it takes an incredibly long time to make. It's not worthwhile making for just one person, and Brian hates eggplant. So it's one of the things, if I see it on a menu, that I will say, wonderful eggplant parmigiana, and will guzzle very, very large quantities of it. But if I had it every day, well, in fact, I wouldn't eat it every day. So look, in cherry season, yes, it's cherries. In mango season, it's a mango, and a mango is one of the few fruits, because they are so sweet at the height of the season, like a very, very good watermelon at the height of the season. They're one of the few fruits that really taste better chilled, because chilling, of course, reduces sweetness and reduces flavour. And a mango and a very, very ripe good melon can stand up to being chilled, whereas most fruits are far better just picked and even sun-warmed, just to bring out the real depth of flavour in it. A strawberry, straight from the ground, a passion fruit, warm from the vine, they're exquisite. And any food which has been stored, cold stored or even stored for a while, loses its flavour. Sorry, that's not quite true. There are some things which have been bred to be stored. Late season apples like Sturma Pippin and some varieties of quince have been bred so that they do need 2 or even 3 months of storage to actually be really good. A Lady Williams apple, which has been stored for 2 months, it becomes slightly shriveled, it loses its colour, it looks incredibly unappetizing. But when you slice it, it's magnificent. And having thin slices of that apple, or thin slices of a month-old Berbosque pear with a very, very good cheese. The cheese, just like the apple or the pear, is all the better for having been kept. So, yes, there are some fruits and foods which have been created or bred to be stored, and are best with the storage. But even then, it's not cold storage. Cold storage actually robs things of their flavour. And that, I think, is one of the great tragedies of the modern age, is that we have now got generations who have never actually tasted good food in their lives. They've never tasted how good an apple is. Often when I eat a piece of fruit when I'm away from home, and I think, look, no wonder kids aren't eating fruit or vegetables. This really just doesn't taste very good. Eating a peach from a supermarket, I've never found a good apricot in a supermarket. But even things like cake. A few years ago, we were having a lovely little school was actually coming to visit us. And so I made a great big enormous cake. I mean, it was an absolutely massive cake. And I was waiting for the kids to actually tuck into it, thinking, oh, cake, cake, cake. And they weren't interested until one kid actually took a slice and looked up and yelled out, hey, everyone, eat this. It's really good. And these were kids who had never eaten a homemade cake. What? Again, eating most cakes, or actually rather not eating them, my husband is continually being tempted by cakes which look absolutely beautiful in their glass container in a cafe. But once you take a bite or two, you realise they don't have the flavour, they don't have the texture, they've been overbeaten, so their texture is dry. They're simply not delicious cakes. You need to know the very, very few places where the person in the kitchen actually really does know how to make a cake. And there are very, very, very few of them. Food these days has been created to be eaten by the eyes. Highly coloured fruit, cakes which are beautifully decorated and look in lovely layers and look superb, or even that phase of actually colouring biscuits into different peculiar colours, etc. They look fantastic, but they really don't taste of much. One of the best cooks I know, Chris, his wife lost the use of her eyes when she was 4 years old. She's now in her 50s. And Chris, who loves cooking, has been cooking for a woman who does not eat with her eyes. She eats with her nose, she eats with her taste buds, and then they both love food. But he cooks magnificently. because what it looks like is simply not a criteria. It's the texture, it's the flavour. And his wife, of course, who has learnt to use all of her senses very, very, very well to compensate for not being able to see, is one of the best judges of food that I know in terms of texture, mouthfeel, the whole range of things that goes into making something completely and utterly delicious. And for me, if people don't take third helpings, I assume that a dish has failed. It should be so good that you simply want more and more. And the third helping will be very small, but eaten very, very, very slowly indeed.
Jackie French, you are an inspiration. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
No, an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. You can send feedback to actsofkitchen@gmail.com. Please consider leaving a review on iTunes to help other people find me, and check out my Patreon page too. Happy cooking.